problems of working on an artist about whom there is no biographical material at all, and indeed very little information of any kind. It's an attempt, almost like a Sherlock Holmes attempt in many cases, to resurrect a personality on the strength of a few documents and, of course, on the related works. The concept of the artist as a divine creator, someone who is practically a god, or the alternative concept of the artist as a bohemian character whose personal behavior can tolerate all sorts of idiosyncrasies, is not something that belongs to the medieval period. It's from Renaissance times onward that we get an interest in the heroic qualities that are associated with creative work, and from the 19th century onwards, when the artist begins to have competition, for instance, in the field of photography, and in the 20th century, where a great deal of communication is done through the means of television, these are the means which compete with the artist in the function that he employed in the past. Today, we expect something very different from the artist, from what existed in the medieval period, when he formed a normal part of society, and often a very humble part of society. I'd like to show you some of these slides, some alternative slides. Let's see what happens. Dim lights and so on. Now, these, of course, are not medieval. I'm showing you the alternative convention here, so to speak, because on the left-hand side, we have the work of Picasso. Picasso, in fact, in his studio, an artist about whom we know a great many biographical details, whose private life has become public, whose mistress, whose illegitimate children we know about the fight for his inheritance. This is the type of thing that we associate with the artist today. On the other side, we see something of the prestigious status that the artist could hold, say, in the late 18th century. For this is one of Reynolds' self-portraits, a portrait made by an artist who was the first president of the Royal Academy in London, and who was also an intellectual, who mixed perhaps less with painters and more with the intelligentsia of London at that time. We have here a type of status symbol, almost, in the work of the artist. Clearly, I've done the wrong thing. Is that the one I should use? Well, this scientific age really was too much for me, but the thing is that you know I'm coming from the medieval period, so you can't really expect me to press the right buttons. Here you have the artist, perhaps, at his most prestigious in the 17th century. On the right-hand side, you have the famous painting by Velázquez of Las Meninas, and here you see the artist who actually takes his place in court, who paints on the easel on the one side with the king, Philip IV, and his queen of Spain, in the mirror on the other side, and the children of the royal family, and also some of their attendants in the foreground. On the left-hand side, you have Vermeer in his studio, and you can see one of the qualities here that Leonardo claimed for the painter in his superiority to the sculptor, for instance. The painter can work without getting dirty. The sculptor, of course, has to carve away with stone, and he gets dusty and dirty. So a status symbol again. Now, when we go to the medieval period, there is no evidence in science that any great evolutionary change took place in the human being in the past 2,000 years, or over even more than the past 2,000 years. So that when we look at an artist who worked in this period, and it's a rather extensive period, when we look at this type of work, we can assume that the people were just as human as we are here today. But, of course, they were conditioned in a different way, and they lived in a different social milieu, and they had a different status. In the early medieval period, most of the work that was done by artists was done by people who worked mostly in monasteries, who were actually part of a religious order. Nevertheless, at times they did bring in something of their personal attitude. Here, on the one hand, on the left-hand side, is a work of the early 9th century. It comes from a silver gilt altar frontal, which is in Milan in the church of Sant'Ambrogio. And here we find the artist intruding into one of the most religious works that one can expect at the time, because we have Volvinus. He describes himself, he names himself, and St. Ambrose on the right-hand side. And what is St. Ambrose doing? He is crowning the artist. So Volvinus suffered from no false modesty. On the right-hand side, we also see someone who was connected with a monastery, but at a later period, in the 12th century. And he too describes himself, because he mentions in this little figure here, which is incorporated in the initial R, we have a figure who is actually finishing the initial from within the work. That is Brother Rufilus, and he mentions himself, he gives himself his own mortality, immortality. Now, when we go into the later Middle Ages, and from the 13th century onwards, we find that art tends to move, religious art, any art, tends to move out of the monasteries and into the great cities, and particularly into those cities where we have university centers. The center that I am particularly concerned with is Paris, because not only did it have one of the earliest and the most important of the universities of the time, but also it had a royal patronage which is responsible for much of the development of the art of the later medieval period, which encouraged artists and which supplied an enormous patronage for their works. Now, we've moved on considerably, because the artists whom I work on are mostly in the later Middle Ages, and they belong to this milieu, who work not in monasteries, but who work in cities, sometimes, as in the case of Jean Poussel, whom I'm going to talk about first, in Paris, in an area where art is concentrated, where, in fact, scribes who would write the books would be associated with the area near the university, and where the artists who decorated them would have their own quarter. We know this because we have tax books showing what they actually paid on their particular properties. Now, again, we find the individual artist intruding, expressing something of his own personality, but also telling us something about the times in which he worked. Here, for instance, and this is a text of, it's a Boccaccio text, Boccaccio's famous men and women, and these are some of the women who are actually incorporated in it. Now, when Boccaccio was writing, many of the people whom he wrote about were, in fact, heroes and heroines of the ancient world. Instead, we find these people portrayed as contemporary people in general, and in this case, as artists. And of course, the artist portraying himself actually working is of particular interest and particularly revealing as regards the techniques that they actually used. Here, for instance, on the left-hand side, and it's interesting that they are women working at this period, you have the figure painting a virgin and child, one of these icons that is very much in demand, could in fact be practically mass-produced, and the little figure of her attendant. She's working with a palette, and although this is the period just after 1400, she's probably using oil colors, something that used to be attributed to a later period of the 15th century. On the other side, you see something that is perhaps even more surprising, because we have here a woman who is actually painting her self-portrait and looking in a mirror for this purpose. We don't have self-portraits of this period, but we have the evidence in these little works that they actually exist. Here, again, something that reminds us, we're still actually working with these women artists on the left-hand side. We have an artist who is painting a statue. Now, when we look at the great cathedrals of Europe, what we see is not a blaze of color. When we walk into Notre Dame or Chartres Cathedral, we find, in fact, that these statues are really stone-colored. But in the Middle Ages, most of these statues were painted and have had a very much more realistic aspect because of this color. So here we have the evidence in this particular miniature that this actual technique is actually being used. It's important also because it means that painters are working on the work of sculptors, and an intelligent artist who works on the work of another artist is bound to notice if anything very interesting is happening there and to derive some benefit from it. Now, clearly, we've seen from Volvinus that artists very frequently admired their own work. They also liked to be commemorated in their work. And here we see one of the outstanding examples of an artist who admired his own work, Pygmalion. Pygmalion, who created his statue, who admired it so much that he fell in love with it, and who prayed to Venus that Venus might grant his statue life. Well, let's see how he went about it. Well, I think Pygmalion's intentions are quite clear. And Venus granted his request. And having granted his request, Pygmalion starts dressing his statue. And in the final episode from this little saga, Pygmalion and his Galatea go and give thanks to Venus. Probably they lived happily ever after. Now, as regards the actual social status of the artist, we not only learn something about the way in which they worked. On the right-hand side, we have something that's very rare indeed. In the Middle Ages, we have a pattern book. Originality was not at a premium as it is today in the art of the Middle Ages. You had to be an efficient worker, but provided you produced reasonably good work, your technique had to be sound, it would be examined by some of your colleagues, and if it wasn't good, you wouldn't be paid. And of course, nothing can be more drastic than that. We do know, with this lack of originality, and there have at all times only been a very, very few great original artists, the majority are followers. And if, in fact, you have a few original artists and a lot of followers, it's very useful to have pattern books in the workshop so that from this process one can more or less mass produce. We're in the period, of course, before printing, before any other type of mass production. And this is exactly what happened. The work on the right-hand side comes from a 13th century sketchbook by an architect who appears also to have been a sculptor. and who went from northeast France to Hungary, making notes as he went along, making sketches, and in this particular illustration, giving us also some idea of the way in which they actually formalized their drawing. This is a type of schematization here, which reduces the irregular features with which we are all possessed to these geometric forms that we see imposed on these figures. So if you're not very good at drawing, it's a good idea to know, in fact, some of the basic shapes, and by this means, then, to fit your figures into them. On the right-hand side, we have a work of the 15th century by Jan van Eyck. And in this case, we also, it's a religious work, it actually shows St. Barbara. St. Barbara's symbol was the tower. Behind her is a tower, but in this case, it's actually being built. And in the foreground, we find the people who are building it. And from this, we also learn something about the building techniques. Now, it isn't only from manuscripts themselves that we learn something about the Middle Ages. We also learn from documents, from accounts, but on the whole, no biographical accounts. And we learn about this time that also the idea of the architect as someone rather special is beginning to emerge. And we learn it because some of the people who are working under the master masons, as they used to be called, begin to complain that some people, these people who simply draw designs, are getting far more money than they are, and they are doing all the work. So here we have the idea of the artist beginning to emerge as a special type of person. And this is something, of course, which is pursued in Renaissance times. And we still have, in spite of a great many out-of-work artists, we still have something of this idea lingering on. Now, the book that you see on the screen, there are two openings from it, is a very tiny work. It's actually 9 by 6 centimeters, which is perhaps, well, I think even smaller than the palm of my hand. Yet when Panofsky wrote his book on early Netherlandish painting, he spoke of this particular artist, whose name is Jean Poussel, the first of the artists whom I'm going to talk about, and he called Purcell the Giotto or the Duccio of the North. Now, those of you who know your Italian painting will know that Giotto particularly worked on a very monumental scale. We find the great Italians working in fresco, and Duccio himself, although he worked in panel painting, worked again on a relatively monumental scale. In Paris, we don't get this same type of interest in the monumental. And Dante, when speaking of Paris, spoke of it as the center of illumination, where, in fact, the pride of the city was the power of its illuminators. So here we find, on this tiny scale, some of the inventions that found expression in Italy coming in really on a microscopic scale. But at the same time, because of the fact that this was happening in Paris, because of the fact that there was patronage from the royal family and that there was a continuous tradition which was going to continue until the end of the Middle Ages, we find these new ideas becoming available to artists in Northern Europe. Now, what is so very new about this? Well, I should probably have brought along an earlier work which would show that, demonstrate very clearly that artists in Northern Europe before the 14th century saw designs primarily in a two-dimensional way. The idea of perspective, of the third dimension, the illusion of space, which goes back to antiquity, had to a large extent been forsaken in the period of the Middle Ages. With Giotto and Duccio in Italy, we find in the period of the Renaissance a going back to the antique, to the exploration of space. Now, what you see here is not logic. It's not fully realized. It's not one-point perspective or anything like that. But it's an artist who has created figures which have volume and who realizes that these figures must have space in which to move and in which to breathe. Now, how do we know that this book was done by Jean Poussin? I've told you that we have no biographies of the period. In fact, we have five tiny documents of a very miscellaneous kind which introduce us to this artist. Two of them are connected with the book that is now in front of you, a book which is known either as the Hours of Poussin. Book of Hours is a type of prayer book which became very popular in the late Middle Ages and could, in fact, have considerable personal expression in the form of individual prayers, portraits of the owner, etc. We have two mentions of this particular book. It was made for a queen, and the queen, who was married to the King of France in 1325 to 1328, received the work from her husband. So it dates to this particular period. She herself did not die until 1370. She passed it on to the then King of France, so it turns up in her last will and testament. And then finally, we find that the work itself passed to that great patron of the arts, the Duke of Berry, who was in the late 14th and early 15th century, again having many manuscripts made. The queen in question is Jeanne d'Evreux, and the manuscript is now in the cloisters in New York. We have two other works. We have three, actually, other works which connect with this. From the patronage of the Charles Le Bel, who was the husband of Jeanne d'Evreux, we can gather that this was an artist who had considerable prestige in Paris. We know that he was employed by a royal family. The object which you see on the left-hand side is actually a seal. It brings in a different type of patronage altogether. That of a confraternity, the confraternity of St. James, where the members would have been more likely to be butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, and people of this nature than kings and queens. And from this, and this is where the detective work has to come in, we can also deduce that good, solid tradesmen in the city of Paris had some respect for this artist, whose work suggests in some ways that he was not born in Paris, because there are considerable Flemish reflections in this rather international style that he developed, but that he must have been there and that he must have been highly regarded. The original seal was found in the 19th century. It was dragged up from the Thames. Not from the Thames, sorry, from the Seine, reflections of going back to London, from the Seine. It was lost after this. It's amazing how many things have been lost from the archives in Paris. Even the impression was lost. But we do have a rather poor engraving which shows some idea of what the original looked like. It's more of more interest for the patronage which is suggested here and the status of the artist than for the quality of the work. The other work that you see on the right-hand side comes from the third work, which is associated by some tangible evidence with the name of Poussin. And this is a Bible which is now in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, where an inscription at the end of the book tells us who the scribe was. The scribe was Robert de Billing, and also tells us that the three artists who illustrated the work were Jean Poussin, Anciot de Sens, and Jacquet Massy. So we know that this was an artist who worked with other people, and if you're trying to work on a stylistic basis, this is, can be very confusing. The final work, which associates with the name of Jean Poussel, has a different type of documentation. It's a very different approach to art history from simply going out to the local store and buying a monograph on your favorite artist. In this case, we have at the bottom of one of the pages in this particular breviary, which is known as the Belleville Breviary. It was originally made for Jeanne de Belleville, who apparently, at the time that she ordered this Dominican breviary, was a widow, was thinking of going into a Dominican convent, but was saved from the veil by a remarriage to Olivier de Clisson. The book, when Olivier de Clisson was later accused of treason, came into royal possession, his effects were confiscated, so this book too entered the royal collection. Now, in this case, we have a few little notes of a type that must have existed on many manuscripts simply at the bottom of the page, and one of them says that J. Poussel paid Jean Chevrier a certain amount of money. Well, from this, we can deduce, of course we can always be wrong in our deductions, but we can deduce that Poussel employed people and that he was a master of a workshop. Now, in attempting to go a little bit further, we do, of course, have to work on a stylistic basis to try to recreate as much as possible just what this person was like and how his style actually developed. In this case, the Belleville Breviary is the best guide to the development of the artist and his workshop, because it had a very unusual iconography associated with its calendar. Most of these books had calendars at the beginning, and they give the various saints' days that are associated with the months. They also can have subsidiary illustration, very often simply the sign of the zodiac. Of course, we are very used to this today in an age interested in astrology. And they also could show, usually, the occupation of the month. This particular iconography was so unusual that the artist actually included a description of it and gave the meaning, because he introduces a religious connotation so that in this particular miniature, which represents the month of December, you see two figures at the bottom of the page, a crumbling building on one side. The crumbling building is the synagogue, which is being pulled down brick by brick. From these bricks, which are handed over to an Old Testament prophet, an apostle takes the veil away and reveals an article of faith. So this is really an attempt at illustrating the creed. These various articles of faith are reproduced in the upper part of the manuscript, and since St. Paul was not actually one of the apostles, we find that St. Paul is shown talking and preaching to the various people to whom he wrote his letters. On the right-hand side, you see a little illustration showing something of the type of landscape that the artist associated with the month of December. Now, we do not have the entire iconography that is described by the artist. The various bricks which are taken from the synagogue should be assembled and should build the church. These are the bricks from which the church is subsequently to be built. That part does not survive, but we have in a number of other manuscripts a continuation of the same tradition and the repetition of this calendar, which must have appealed to people very much at the time, so that they asked for repetitions of it. And for almost a century, we have a line taking us from this particular workshop in the 1320s into the 15th century. are two of the copies, later copies, of the Belleville Breviary calendar. Both of these were done for the Duke of Berry. The one on the left-hand side, a work of the 1380s. The one on the right-hand side, the Gromser, which was completed in 1409. Now, many of the other illustrations in these books are, of course, of a very different nature. But because of this link, we can build up the connection of a workshop which flourished, which was handed down from one person to another, and where the same patterns were used, and can establish the continuity of over this very long period. What one finds by looking at the various people who were associated with these works is that almost every artist who worked in Paris at this time would seem to have passed through Jean Poussel's workshop at one time or another. Now, one of the fascinating things about the Hours of Jeanne d'Evreux, the little cloisters book, is not simply that it introduces Italian ideas of perspective, but that also it introduces an aspect of medieval art which is of importance in determining the character of much later developments. For instance, if you know the art of Bosch at the end of the 15th and early 16th century, we find a fantasy in the work of this artist which would be impossible had it not been for the freedom, the license of which artists were given to do anything they liked, to introduce the grotesque, the fantastic, to introduce also the contemporary, to put their own portraits in, to do anything. This freedom allows for the development of that type of fantasy and also for a type of genre painting which was not being pursued to the same extent in Italy. Now, not only the Belleville Breviary, but also a large number of figures and also a large number of these little comic strip elements, these drolleries or grotesque figures, also fall into the repertoire which must have existed in a pattern book and which are repeated. Here, for instance, on the left-hand side, you have the Belleville Breviary, which was made between 1323 and 1326. On the other side, you have the Gromser made in 1409, exactly the same drollery figures. Simply another aspect of the Gromser, several other pages, where a number of these same drollery figures come in. And this is one of the charms of these books. And in fact, quite small children at this time were frequently given very expensive books. Of course, they had to be, you know, rather well-heeled children because these were expensive books. But they were given this type of book to learn to read from, and in the margins they would find their interest in the drollery figures and their amusement in those figures. Now, in this complex of works which accumulates around the workshop of Jean Poussel, we find that we can even deduce where Poussel got his Italian ideas from. No artist at this time who had been trained to look at figures in terms of flat pattern could possibly have learned from to explore space in this way unless he had a direct experience of a different culture and one in which this was actually being explored. And when we begin to look into these works, we find that, for instance, on the left-hand side, where you see this tower, we have a reflection of the tower on the city hall in Siena. And although the one on the right-hand side is, of course, a photograph, on the left-hand side, it has been introduced into a city scene where a miracle is taking place, an army is being driven off. This is one of the miracles of the Virgin. and the simply a portrait of the Virgin is enough to drive the besieging enemy away. So we know that the tower at Siena was being looked at by these artists, and when we look at Duccio's Maestà, which was created for the Cathedral of Siena but is now in the museum attached to the cathedral, we find confirmation of this in a number of the other miniatures. Here, for instance, you have the scene from the early life of Christ, the adoration of the kings when they come to see the Christ child. But it's shown in a different way. It's shown in a way which was associated with Franciscan thought in Italy and which could have been seen in Duccio's Maestà on the right, on your, yeah, your left-hand side, and where the old king kneels down and kisses the child's foot. This iconography is simply copied over into the Belleville Breviary. Also from the Ars of Jean d'Evreux, we're going back to the tiny little manuscript that we looked at originally, we find again that something of this same reflection, the crucifixion, for instance, on the left-hand screen, can again be compared with Duccio's Maestà, but we find here the exuberance of the marginal decoration, which reflects a different culture altogether, that of Flanders. And this exuberance, this development of something which is really a very much more of a genre nature, where there is no established pattern which must be followed, is something which allows for the development of a much greater liveliness in the main miniatures of the artist. On the left, on your right-hand side, you also have in the lamentation scene, this is the scene where Christ is being mourned over in the deposition into the tomb, again, a reflection of the art of Siena. And in this interest in space, which is, of course, not completely understood, which is a very new thing, which is experimental, some of the more revealing aspects are to be found in the attempts of the artist to create space in novel ways where, at times, he doesn't even succeed. Some of the failures are perhaps more revealing than some of the successes. In the scene on the left-hand side, and these scenes, which illustrate a series of prayers associated with the Virgin, have a double illustration. They not only show the life of the Virgin, the cycle which is associated with her life and the childhood of Christ, but they also show the series of the Passions. So you have a double illustration, which merely means that this artist, in spite of the very small scale in which he is working, is determined to put in as much illustration as he can possibly do. Here, on the left-hand side, you find that he is aware that these figures, which are really very sculptural and are probably based on sculpture, are protruding from his page and need some sort of suggestion of enclosure in an architectural setting. He hasn't managed it. But on the right-hand side, where you see one figure peeping through, you get the suggestion of a door which is opening out. And on the extreme left, you see this type of arm which should suggest a wing and a type of enclosure for the space, but in fact doesn't quite manage it. On the other side, you have a scene which shows one of the miracles of St. Louis. St. Louis was very beloved by the royal family of France, and I suppose if any of us had a king and a saint in our ancestry, well, we would also put him into our books too. So we have St. Louis here in one of his acts of piety, and in this case, we have a type of canopy type of three-dimensional canopy which attempts, again, to cover these sculptural figures. And much of the sculpture at the time was also covered by canopies. Now, when one works on the basis of a very, very small amount of evidence of this kind, one can go quite a long way. And also, because of the continuation of a tradition, it's very difficult to know just when the original artist may have died and when, because for the most part in the Middle Ages, workshops passed from father to son. If there was no son, then the daughter's husband, or in any case, some relative of the family inherited the workshop. There would be a very close connection, and very often the succeeding artist would have worked with the older artist for a very long time. It's very difficult then to know where, in fact, one artist finishes and another takes over. It's not like the work of Picasso, where in the 20th century, where one day he can work in one style, the blue period, the pink period, and the next day it's the Cubist style. This just doesn't happen in the Middle Ages, and perhaps it's just as well, otherwise our detective work would be even worse than it is now. So here, in fact, we have the break. And I myself was rather unlucky in this respect, because I thought Poussel lived a little bit longer than he did. And after I had published on him, a document was discovered which actually told us that he died in 1334. So one can never be too cautious, but the only thing is, if one is always cautious, nothing would ever be published. The book on the right, which is also in the cloisters, they have been collecting some very delectable manuscripts recently, is therefore in the continuation, but still before the period of the Black Death. It shows something which perhaps rather relates to the idea of death, which was current in the middle of the 14th century, period when plague was rampant. It shows the confrontation of the three living with the three dead, the recognition by the three living that, in fact, this was their own future. Now, one likes to get a change every now and then, and if one sits in libraries and works on manuscripts, it's rather nice for a change to go outside and look at something rather larger than 9 by 6 centimeters. And what we're looking at now is the artist whose work we have been looking at also in the medieval workshop on late medieval Burgundy. And his name is Klaus Sluter. Now, with Klaus Sluter, we move into a different period. Poussel, working in a workshop on his own, independently in Paris, later in the 14th century, we find that kings, dukes, begin to adopt that particular trend which results in the type of thing that we have seen, for instance, in the 17th century, where an artist like Velázquez is attached to the court. In this case, the artist is directly employed by the king or the duke. He is given the title of valet de chambre, and he has a place in the court life of the period. He is entitled to have a seal, and indeed he has to have a seal, because as the head of a workshop, he has to certify the payment of his assistants. Now, in the case of Sluter, we have a great deal more documentation than in the case of Jean Poussel. But we know very, very little about his early life. He first turns up in Brussels. And this was something that was only discovered in relatively recent times, because he appears registered in the Guild of Stonemasons and Sculptors in Brussels about 1379 or 1380. And in that account, he is described as Klaus Sluter van Heerlen, So an artist who is born in Haarlem, which is in the county of Holland, now Holland, of course, the country, and who moves to Brussels. We know nothing of what he did in Brussels. We can only, after all, it's a country which has been the cockpit of Europe. A great deal has been destroyed there. And we only pick up the threads again when we find him in 1385, adopted by the Duke of Burgundy, not as the head of his workshop, but as a rather poorly paid assistant working for the major figure at that time, who is not on the official scale at this time, because Klaus Schlüter earned 8 sous per day, but for this 8 sous, he had to maintain 2 servants, one of them a working assistant, one of them a domestic assistant, and he had to keep a horse. So, and his payment was conditional on this, whereas a quite lowly musician at the court would have earned this without having these particular conditions. So the sculptor's still rather low, still getting his clothes dirty, and still rather low on the social scale. The documents that tell us about Schlüter are not of the nature that we find in the manuscripts associated with Pucelle. They are really the type of accounts. They're connected for the most part with the financial arrangements of the Duke of Burgundy, whose far-flung territories necessitated the establishment of something of a civil service and the keeping of accounts, which were often kept in duplicate and sometimes even in triplicate. Now, the trouble with accounts is that they tell you what people were paid for something. They tell you sometimes details about boxes being made, about transport of various statues. They never tell you any of the personal details about the artist. We know that Schlüter was apparently highly thought of by Philip the Bold of Burgundy. He was sent on different missions for him. He went back to Belgium at times. He visited one of the chateaux of the Duke of Berry. And in 1404, he himself entered a monastery. Now, entering a monastery doesn't necessarily mean that you take the vows and are never seen again. He went in as a special type of entrant to the monastery. He was allowed to take his servant with him. He was allowed to come and go as he pleased. And he was allowed his wine and the various rations that the other monks had. It was a monastery of Augustinian canons. For this, he paid a sum of money. He lived 2 years, the last 2 years of his life, in the monastery and completed some of the work that we find in the the complex where most of his surviving work is enshrined. Now, the figure on the right-hand side, as you can see, is a monk, and he's a Carthusian. And it was just outside Dijon that the Duke of Burgundy established a Carthusian monastery where he intended to place not only his own tomb, but the tombs which would be associated with his line. In other words, it was going to be a type of mausoleum and a memorial to the Valois Dukes of Burgundy. The main object in creating this monastery was to support a number of monks who were noted for their learning, but also for their meditation and their powers to intercede. And these monks would pray in perpetuity for the soul of Philip the Bold. When you go to the Chartreuse de Chaumont today, what you see is not a Carthusian monastery. There has been, since the period of the Revolution, a tremendous transformation in this area. The various effects of the monasteries in France were confiscated, the building was sold, the church was demolished, and The entire territory was taken over and occupied by one of Napoleon's followers, who afterwards entitled himself Count of Chaumont. In 1830, when there was a necessity for building a psychiatric hospital, probably a mental home would be more like it in Dijon at that period, the territory of the Chartreuse de Chaumont seemed to be a suitable place to do this. There was a problem as to what would be done with those surviving works. Only a few objects had survived in position. One was the entrance to the church, where you see in front of you Philip the Bold and Margaret of Flanders, his wife, being presented by their patron saints to the Virgin, who stands in the middle. Originally, there was a canopy with angels. The suggestion is that they are being received into the court of heaven. As, in fact, the Duke was being buried behind this, the funeral connotations are that, as against the idea of a last judgment, that he was, in fact, being accepted at the court of heaven. A closer look at the Duke of Burgundy, the main patron, the patron of Klaus Schluter and his own patron saint. In the rebuilding in the 1830s, it was first of all contemplated that the various works associated with Schluter's name should be moved, perhaps to a museum, perhaps to a park. These are works. They're stone sculptures, of course, fragile to move, probably breakable as they moved, and also, if kept in a park, subject to perhaps vandalism. It was eventually decided to leave them in position and to build the psychiatric hospital around them. So it can be a terrifying experience to look at what was once one of the most tranquil possible types of monasteries, that of the Carthusian monk who retires from the world, who lives in his own little house, who has the greatest tranquility, perhaps closest to the Trappist monks that one can possibly find. Now, in looking at these works, we always have to deduce a great deal about the personality of the artist. We can deduce, of course, from the fact that Schluter actually entered a monastery towards the end of his life, that he did have considerable religious feelings. And I think that this comes out in the character and the spiritual qualities with which he endows his figures. But in a way also, he does seem to have been a type of Renaissance artist in the way in which he had an independence of approach which disregarded the ideas of the forerunner, his previous head of the workshop, and in the way in which he emancipated his figures from the actual architecture against which they were placed. I'm showing you on the right-hand side the type of portal which was originally contemplated when this work was begun and for which the architecture itself was actually adapted. Schluter appears to have completely thrown this idea overboard. It is a relatively conservative idea with the Duke and the Duchess shown standing and not kneeling and simply with a figure in the middle, very firmly attached to the architectural environment. The changed attitude, as you could see in the previous works, the previous views of the portal that we have seen, is very much more like a painting in which the figures simply centralize towards the Virgin and are in a relatively centralized composition, a unified composition. Work that was begun, and of course the whole raison d'etre of the Chartreuse de Chaumont was the tomb of the Duke of Burgundy. It was begun Before Sluter was in charge of the workshop, so again he has to take over another person's concept, and in this case there seems to have been less freedom to change the idea, and the originality of the artist is expressed in the various figures which surround and form a procession around this tomb in black marble, which came from Dinan, with a central core which comes from northern Burgundian quarry, and with alabaster figures, various materials chosen specifically for their actual functional and for their appearance. The Duke of Burgundy died 2 years before Claes Sluter. He died in Hal, which is just outside Brussels, far enough away from Dijon for the funeral procession to take 6 weeks, and with great pomp and ceremony to reach the city of Dijon. He had requested that no matter where he died, he should be brought to his tomb in Dijon, and that he should be buried in the robe of a Carthusian monk. This was actually done, and when this tremendous procession entered Dijon, everyone must have assembled to see it, including Claes Sluter. At this time, the tomb was not finished. The architecture of the tomb was already in the church, but only two of the little figures in the procession were actually incorporated. So what we have in the final version of the funeral procession is a group of people who reflect the original procession, which came from Brussels, or just outside Brussels, down to Dijon. Procession starts with the religious figures, the bishop who officiated, the choristers who took part in the work, and the two Carthusian monks, symbolic of the various of the actual order with which the Duke was associated, and then came the various mourners, some of them associated with the Duke's family, others with his court. In the interpretation of these various figures, we get an enormous differentiation in character. And this is something that is, again, something very new, part of the originality of this artist, because here we have the realism, which is characteristic, which we associate with, say, Van Eyck and Flemish realism in the 15th century. I'd just like to run through some of these. They are really very remarkable. They have a monumentality which perhaps is much greater than one would assume if one knew their actual dimensions, which is only about 14 centimeters high. The material is alabaster, and they are painted, but painted very, very discreetly, simply touched with gold, with coral, rather as one might treat ivories. And the ivory, of course, is rather the same type of color as the alabaster. The figure on the right has been identified, but one cannot be absolutely sure. He is, in any case, a doctor, and he has been identified by as a Gerson, who was a protege of the Duke of Burgundy and Chancellor of the University of Paris. The amazing thing also is that in some cases, without showing the features at all, the expression of grief can be implied simply through the use of the drapery and through gesture. And this is again something which goes back to some of the principles. Although it's not copying in this case from Italy at all, it's finding some of the principles of the classical world when gesture and mood were important in implying the drama of a particular scene. that the mourning angel on the right-hand side is not actually mourning for the Duke of Burgundy. The little figure on the left-hand side is. It's the final figure that I'm showing you from the Duke of Burgundy's tomb. The one on the right is mourning for something of more universal importance, and that is for the Passion of Christ. In the center of the large cloister, and the Carthusian monastery has a very large cloister because the various houses of the 24 monks who formed the convent were built around the cloister. Each monk had his own little house. He lived there. He came out only to perhaps once a week to eat in the refectory. His food was passed into him, and he went occasionally, of course, not as often as some of the other orders, to pray in the church. In the center of this cloister, which was also the cemetery of the monks, we have a monument to the Passion, which at the time it was being built was known as the Great Cross or the Calvary. It's now usually referred to as the Moses Fountain. And on the left-hand side, you see the figure of Moses who gives it this name. Now, at some period before the Revolution, this particular monument had already fallen into disrepair. Above the area on the left, where you see the figures of the prophets, six prophets surround a pedestal, which is simply the base for what was once the pedestal of a cross, which rose 18 feet into the air. It must have been tremendously impressive, but it had to be covered from an early at a very early stage, because it was painted. It was very heavily gilded. It was really an imitation of the goldsmith's art on a colossal scale, and because of this decoration, the roofing of the building at one time, which had fallen into repair, and probably this was responsible for the destruction of the upper part of the monument. So what we look now is a mutilation of what was once a great Calvary, and which had a tremendous religious significance at the time. It was a point of pilgrimage, and was even assigned indulgences for those who came to visit in the right frame of mind. Various fragments of the Calvary were discovered partly by excavation. The torso of Christ was discovered in one of the houses in Dijon. Someone had apparently taken it off at one time when it had come detached from the monument and placed it in a niche in one of the houses. It was restored and is now in the Archaeological Museum at Dijon. What one sees in the Chartreuse de Chaumonol, or rather in the confines of the psychiatric hospital, is the pedestal where we have the figures of Moses, David, and Jeremiah, Zechariah, Isaiah, these prophets, Daniel as well, all of them holding scrolls which prophesy the inevitability of the Passion. Above and between them rise the angels who mourn and weep for the suffering of Christ, and above on a platform was once the Calvary itself, which gave meaning to the whole monument. Again, in these figures, I said that the mourners were only about 14 centimeters high. Here you have figures which are about 6 feet high. These are full-scale figures, a monumental scale. And in this case, the monument was not handed over to Schluter by someone else. He began it from the start. So here we have his conception and his characterization in a way which is perhaps one of the forerunners of the characterization and psychological insight of an artist like Rembrandt, who also, of course, was born in Holland in the 17th century. in the case of the mourning figures, so in the case of the prophets, or in the case of the angels, there is never any repetition. And this is the sign of a very original artist indeed. And actually, Poussin himself was also original in this way, because generally speaking, certain types are copied, or there is some lack of originality. These are my last two slides, and I'm simply comparing here the figure of Zechariah with the figure of, well, it's not a figure actually, it's the painting, a detail of a painting of a cardinal who knew the Chartreuse de Chaumonot and who was responsible for allowing the adoption of certain indulgences there, and that is the Cardinal Albergati, who was painted in the 1430s by Jan van Eyck, and it's Jan van Eyck's painting that you see set against the Zechariah. Some of the realism of the Moses fountain, or the figure of Jeremiah, whom you see here on your left-hand side, was emphasized in earlier times by the fact that Jeremiah was actually given spectacles. He was allowed to wear spectacles, and we have the account which tells us that not only Sluter, but also the painter who painted these figures went to a goldsmith and ordered these spectacles. And I show the painting and the sculpture deliberately here, because in the workshop with which Sluter was associated, he was the master of the sculptors, but the various artists who worked for the Duke worked on a permanent basis. They were paid by the week, or they weren't simply piece workers, and they associated closely with one another. And in this combination and exchange of ideas, in the fact that an artist even works and paints another artist's work, then we have the opportunity for an interchange of ideas, which results, and I think is an important and often an underestimated factor in the development of the realism that we associate with Jan van Eyck and the great portrait painters of the 15th century in Flanders. Thank you.
Professor Moran has indicated that she would be pleased to answer any questions. Yes.
I was interested in the fact that you mentioned that sculptors were rather low status in the 19th period. How do you reconcile that with the fact that there was so much sculpture?
Simply because there was a great need for sculpture. You're thinking of the cathedral facades, aren't you? And that they were very much a natural part of society, but they were not a particularly elevated part of it. I don't think there is any very great problem there. We don't know what the cathedral workshops were paid, because when Chartres Cathedral was being built, or when other cathedrals were being built, a whole workshop, including the glassmakers, the stonemasons, well, rather as one sees in the St. Barbara miniature, were set up. And they were just a natural part of society. They got their wages at the end of each week, and that was it. There was no great prestige about it.
Did Schlüter have any influence on Italian sculptors in his time?
It seems very probable that he did. Ghiberti, in his commentaries, writes about a northern sculptor whose work he admired very much, But the thing that he comments on is that the figures were rather short. And of course, in Schluter's work, this is one of the characteristics. There's a type of breadth to the treatment of the figure and a shortness in it. In some of the work in northern Italy, I think one can see some reflection of this.
One of the last slides you showed appeared to be an amplification of the Moses figure out of the Moses fountain. And there were two little bumps on the edge.
Question the rest of the audience may not have heard.
I've just been asked about the figure of Moses, where in the detail two little horns were sticking out of the head. Now, if you have seen Michelangelo's Moses, you will also find two little horns sticking out of the head. And Michelangelo, of course, was perhaps more classically inclined than Schluter. It arises from a misconception about the fact that when Moses came down from the mountain, there were rays shining from his head like horns. And the metaphor was taken literally. And in much of the art of the medieval period, you see Schluter with horns. It also comes into the medieval drama. And one hears that in the medieval drama, where Moses is introduced, before Moses has been received the tables of the law and before he has seen God, he doesn't have horns. But when he comes down, he puts the horns on. So I think behind these figures, of course, there is a strong influence from the medieval drama. So this could come indirectly from that.
Any other questions? If not, I'd like to make a couple of announcements. First of all, next week's talk will be given by Professor Robert Rosenblum. He will speak on Picasso and the Guernica of 1937. I would also like to mention that should any of you wish to join the Institute who have not already done so, there will be an opportunity to do so as you go out. And I'd like to call on Professor Kolbeck to thank our speaker this evening on our behalf.
Professor Beverly, ladies and gentlemen, I think anything I have to say after this lecture will be rather gilding the lily. We have heard that Professor Morand, I think with some awe and admiration, is a contributor to the Encyclopedia Britannica. But I think now we've heard for ourselves that she makes research into something like detective work as exciting as any bestseller could possibly be. So Professor Morand, you have given us entertainment, knowledge, and enlightenment. And on behalf of all of us, I think I can say thank you very much indeed.
I should make one further announcement. We have intended to have coffee outside as a regular item. We intend to have it this evening, but I understand we have just blown a fuse, so that it may be a few minutes before it is ready, but there will be coffee available shortly. Thank you very much.